You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are. Welcome to our podcast discussion about the patient and physician perspective of diabetic retinopathy, diagnosis, treatment, and progression. My name's Daniel Newman. I'm a diabetes advocate. I've been living with type 1 diabetes for nearly 28 years, and for roughly 7 or 8 of those years, I've been living with diabetic retinopathy. And I'm joined by other diabetes advocates and physicians this evening. Bernadette, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
I'm Bernadette Warren, also known as Bernie. I live in the UK, and I was diagnosed with a complication of diabetic retinopathy, known as diabetic macular edema, in 2011, and I have not been able to work since 2012.
Thank you, Bernadette. And if we go over to Randall.
Hello, all. My name is Randall Barker, and I'm from the U.S., specifically in Texas, and I've had diabetic retinopathy since the early 2000s, although I was not symptomatic until around 2018.
Thank you, Randall. Charles, if you can introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Charles Wyckoff. I am a medical and surgical retina specialist. That's an ophthalmologist, so I'm a medical doctor who got ophthalmology training and then extra training as a retina specialist, and I'm practicing as part of a large academically oriented private practice in Houston, Texas. I'm managing patients with retinal diseases for about 15 years now.
Thank you, Charles. And Stella, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Stella Vujacevic. I'm an ophthalmologist and retina specialist based at the University of Milan at the eye clinic IRX Multimedica.
To get our conversation started, it would be good to have a background what diabetic retinopathy is. And Charles, could you just provide that for us?
Of course. Diabetes mellitus is a very common worldwide medical problem. One of the earliest places where the body can get damaged from diabetes is the eye, and the back of the eye in particular, called the retina. Diabetes mellitus affects many parts of the body, and all of those are important to consider in the management of patients with diabetes. But today we're focusing on diabetic eye manifestations, and in particular, diabetic retinopathy. That abbreviation is often DR. This is something that patients can develop even if they are very well controlled with diabetes. The longer patients have diabetes, the higher their risk of developing diabetic retinopathy. Many times this is asymptomatic when it begins to develop. Patients still can have quite good vision, and it can progress to an advanced form even if patients are minimally symptomatic. And that's one of the key reasons why screening is important, and we'll come back to that. The way patients with diabetes can lose vision are either DME or DMO, depending where you live. The abbreviations can be different. It stands for diabetic macular edema. And briefly, that's when the blood vessels begin to break down and leak. And so the retina becomes boggy and thick with pathologic fluid that causes dysfunction of the retina. And then there's PDR, which stands for proliferative diabetic retinopathy, which is when the eye forms abnormal blood vessels and scar tissue that can bleed and contract and cause retinal detachments. DME and PDR are the two main ways that people lose vision. And the third one, which is common to both of them, is called ischemia or retinal non-perfusion, where the normal blood vessels of the retina don't work as well, and you get a lack of adequate blood flow to the back of the eye that can itself directly cause visual dysfunction.
Thank you, Charles. And we're correct in thinking that diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of vision loss amongst people living with diabetes of working age.
Great question. And the epidemiology here is super important to unpack. There's been a lot of research looking at the different causes of vision impairment around the world. And it's region dependent and it's country dependent. But overall, in most developed countries, diabetic retinopathy is one of the leading causes of irreversible vision loss. Because you can have reversible vision loss, which might be the need for glasses or cataracts. But really, when we think about blindness, it's important to focus on irreversible vision loss. And that's really where diabetic retinopathy becomes a key player. It is reversible at early stages, or manageable at least, but once you get to advanced stages, it can be quite difficult to get the vision back. In the United States and many developed countries, it is the leading cause of irreversible vision loss and blindness among what we describe as the working age population. Now, some countries in particular across the European zone have seen a decrease in the proportion of patients with blindness due to diabetes because of effective screening approaches, which I really applaud those regions for successfully executing. Other countries like the United States really need to get better at universal screening. It's very important that patients get screened, even if they're asymptomatic when they have diabetes.
Thank you, Charles, and really appreciate you providing that background and that foundation for us to go on and have the conversation. Randall, if you can just share with us when you received your diagnosis of diabetic retinopathy and how that conversation went.
So I was going in for a diabetic yearly annual exam, and it was at that time that it was noted on the retinal screening that there were some, what the doctor referred to as dot hemorrhages in my eye. He said, more technically, this is a form of diabetic retinopathy. And what we will do is we will continue to watch these on a yearly basis and develop a course of action if anything were to happen. That was in the early 2000s. And fast forward 15 years plus, I then had one of those hemorrhages actually rupture that resulted in a retinal detachment that then resulted in surgery to correct it.
Were you aware of what the possibilities were at that moment in time, or was that all new to you?
The whole thing was new to me. When I heard the term diabetic retinopathy, I knew that it was a condition caused by diabetes, but to me, it meant this is a condition that's going to eventually cause blindness. I was unaware of the treatment options that were out there at that time. So when that retina detached and I lost vision, I thought, well, this is the vision loss that we have always talked about and that would be coming forth, only to then move into a treatment that actually corrected that.
Thank you for sharing that, Randall. And we'll touch back on the treatment part in just a bit. Bernadette, if I bring you to the conversation and just share your experience of your diagnosis.
So back in 2011, I had sight loss. To be honest with you, I thought I was of the age whereby I needed reading glasses. So I went to the opticians and she looked at my eyes and said, no, your glasses are fine. And you actually need to go to the hospital and have some scans. I was really, really shocked to hear that I had something called diabetic macular edema, which is a maculopathy. When I was diagnosed, I thought that everything was fine. But I'd gone on an insulin pump and I'd brought my sugar levels down very, very quickly and didn't know that was wrong to do. And I was told that I dropped my HbA1c too quickly and it damaged my eyes. And very quickly there I was sitting in the hospital waiting for treatment and I was petrified. I'd never heard of diabetic macular edema. I'd heard of retinopathy, but the language of maculopathy is just not used as much as retinopathy is. It's a maculopathy for me that has really caused my vision issues.
Thank you, Bernadette. And if I just look back at my own diagnosis, I think it was maybe 2017 or maybe 2016, where I had floaters in my eye. And that was a real worry for me. And I thought automatically I was going to lose my vision. And went to the emergency A&E to get my eyes checked, and the doctor that I saw was quite relaxed about it. And I look back at part of that now and I realize the reason why they were relaxed in comparison to me is because they were aware of the treatment pathway. And touching a bit on what Randall said, I wasn't aware of that treatment pathway, and my assumption was as soon as you get a problem with your eyes, you lose your vision. There was no understanding of what happened in between. And Bernadette, where you mentioned about feeling petrified, I had feelings similar to those, and there were lots of emotions that came up during that period of time. But I also look at where I am now and look at who I was back then, and my understanding of diabetic retinopathy has completely changed and evolved over the years that have passed. from understanding about treatments available, what I need to do to manage my type 1 diabetes better in terms of the impact it has on my eyes and going to appointments and screenings. And I wonder if that's the same for either of you, Bernadette and Randall. Has your understanding of diabetic retinopathy evolved over the years that you've been living with the condition?
Yeah, when I was diagnosed, I'd never heard of diabetic macular edema, so I definitely was looking up that, and I really wanted to understand what was going wrong with my eyes. So I learned how to read OCTs, what microns were, and the fovea, which is part of your eye, really important for central vision. And I wanted to know what the treatments were going to be, because I literally shook with fear, literally, when I was told I'd need eye injections. I'd never heard of them, but I wanted to know how they worked. I think learning about that and the treatments available were really important for me to understand the process and come to terms with it.
Thank you, Bernard. And Randall?
Yeah, what I have learned since my treatment is that diabetic retinopathy seems to be a term that kind of covers several different diagnoses, as Charles touched on. I've also learned that they're coming with those, there are different treatments. My understanding of diabetic retinopathy has definitely evolved as I've gone through this process.
Thank you both for sharing that. So we've spoken about our experiences of the diagnosis of diabetic retinopathy and perhaps touching on something that Charles and Bernadette spoke about, screening. Stella, if you could just give us your kind of perspective on screening programs.
Thank you, Daniel. So the screening of diabetic retinopathy has proven to be very important in preventing to lose sight. However, this procedure, even if very costly effective, has not been widely adopted worldwide. We know that it has been adopted, for example, in the UK at the national level, and also in some countries of the northern part of Europe. However, in the southern part of Europe, in the United States and other parts of the world, it unfortunately has not been implemented at the national levels. And less than 50% of diabetic patients are inside, let's say, the screening programs. The lack of knowledge and awareness of diabetic retinopathy from the patient's point of view is some of the major barriers for attending these screening programs. Definitely, the younger patients have more difficulty in attending screening programs because of the war. So that's something that should be more explained from all the physicians' point of view, not just the ophthalmologists, but also the endocrinologists and GPs to the patients with diabetes mellitus, that they need to undergo regular screening of their fundus to be early diagnosed and early referred to the specialist for retinopathy.
I think Stella summarized that perfectly, and I fully agree. It's interesting, all of our participants here have mentioned the same theme, which is education, right? So many patients with diabetes are simply not aware of the possibility of their eye becoming affected. And so just making sure that there is good education across all of our healthcare providers, as Stella said. I mean, anybody that's seeing anybody with diabetes, no matter what your role in healthcare, no matter what initials you have after your name, should be aware that patients with diabetes need to get eye care screening. I think some areas across Europe have done a much better job of unifying around that than we have in the U.S., but we certainly all can do better. The other angle to it is really emphasizing the asymptomatic nature of diabetic retinopathy, because people can have very advanced disease in their eyes and have no idea that there's a growing problem in the back of their eye until there's a major vision loss episode. And a lot of people with diabetes are working age and they have jobs and they have kids. This becomes less important when their vision's normal and they don't think it's going to happen to them. But really sort of emphasizing the need for screening. And the last point I would make is the economics. In a universal healthcare system, I think this is easier to do. In the U.S., healthcare is fragmented. And so patients often have to pay for their screening, which is another major barrier to care access. And so whatever we can do to educate and then create as low barriers to screening as possible, I think is where we need to go.
something that I think is another issue is fear. Because I think that when you have diabetes, you are told straight away, if you don't look after your diabetes, you're going to go blind. And a lot of people worry that something is happening in the back of their eye and they don't know about it. And they almost don't want to face that. And I think what things are changing positively as far as treatment is concerned. Whereas years ago, there was very little they could do for you. That is a message it needs to gotten across as well, that there is hope in treatment now. You don't need to worry so much because it used to mean you could lose your sight. But actually now, if we get on this quickly, that won't be the case.
I think Bernadette rose up a very important point that we have different treatments now available. And this treatment, if delivered earlier, can preserve your sight. That's why it's important to do the screening at the earliest stages of the disease. And if the treatment is needed, start it promptly and not arrive at the very late stages of the disease where there is a significant reduction of vision, because then it is very difficult to improve it.
Thank you, Stella. And seeing as we're talking about treatment, Randall, I'd like to bring you into the conversation here, particularly just talking about early intervention and kind of getting that early treatment.
You know, looking back on my experience, I think if I would have had, how do I say it, a more eager ophthalmologist that would have suggested some of the preventative treatments, that they would have probably delayed some of the initial rupturing of the vessels that happened in my particular case. And I absolutely do think that the preventative measures would help. In my case, while I had the damage to my right eye, we were looking at the left eye as well. And there were some capillaries of issue that the ophthalmologist was worried about. And that doctor recommended that we go ahead and let's do some laser treatment as well as some injections and get into that preventive mindset to prevent any issues with the left eye creeping up. So, yeah, I absolutely think the preventative measures are worth pursuing.
Thank you for sharing that, Randall. Really appreciate that. And I think if I look at my own experience, the simple answer is yes, of course, early intervention is wanted when it comes to treatment, because you don't want things to get worse. And you want to do whatever is possible to stop things getting worse. When I look at the treatment that I was offered, it was mainly just laser treatment. And when I had to bleed in my right eye, it was vitrectomy surgery. But Bernadette, although I know we're both based in the UK, my understanding is that what was offered to you in terms of treatment is very different to what was offered to me.
Yeah. So when I was diagnosed in 2011, I needed eye injections. And at the time, there was only one anti-VEGF drug. That was it, nothing else. And what has been so encouraging is because of research, there are now many other anti-VEGF drugs that can be used. It's a much more positive picture now for patients coming forward. There's all these new treatment options which are carrying on. Goodness me, it's a different world really from where I started. The injection I was given wasn't even approved to be used in the eye. Being told you're going to need eye injections, and oh, by the way, the drug we're going to inject directly into your eye isn't actually approved to be used in your eye, was really, really nerve-wracking.
Thank you, Bernadette. So we've spoken about treatment, and we've spoken about the treatment we've received, but what about the other side of the treatment, dealing with hospitals, having to go to appointments, the things that we're having to fit into our lives whilst managing type 1 diabetes and diabetic retinopathy?
That opens up a whole conversation even related to getting treatment here in the US versus Europe and other countries. Of course, there are enormous amount of costs that are associated with the treatment and everything here in the U.S., whereas many folks, unfortunately, do not have insurance. And so those costs are a negative for a bunch of people out there. For myself, it was juggling of all the different appointments, as you touched on, not only appointments that we have to do with as being a person with diabetes type 1, but also now seeing the ophthalmologist. So it's just another doctor visit in this long list of ones with a chronic condition.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Randall. And Bernadette?
I was working at the time that I was first diagnosed, and I had to try and make sure my treatments were outside of work time, but also gave me an opportunity to recover from that injection before I went back into work the next day. So that was a little bit of juggling. I'm juggling not just DMO appointments, but glaucoma appointments, cataract appointments as well. I've just had my left cataract done. So yeah, it's basically a full-time job trying to fit hospital appointments in. I think something that would really have helped me was to have known a bit more about what happens if, you know, the positive, what happens if I have eye issues. So I think now at diagnosis, we could start talking about, okay, if this was to happen to you, don't worry, there's a plan in action. There's these treatments. And I think people living with diabetes need to know much earlier on what the pathway is so that they don't panic when something goes wrong. They already know something is already in the pipeline, if you know what I mean.
I think those were some great points. I think you're right. Healthcare providers, we focus on the importance of screening and the blindness, and we probably don't emphasize enough. The reason we want to screen is that if you catch people early enough, you don't have to go blind from this disease. It should be very rare for people to truly go blind from diabetes, that they're getting the care that they need and that they deserve. You're right, there is a plan in place, all sorts of options for management, as long as we catch these patients early enough. And the hopeful side of that, you're right, needs to be communicated more broadly. And then the second point is, we all know the eye is small, and so it's natural. You think, well, can't one doctor do the whole eye? But it's amazing how many different specialists it takes to care for the eye. Right, you got the cataract doc, the retina doc, the glasses doc, glaucoma doc, the nerve doc. I mean, it goes on and on. And you could spend your whole time just seeing eye doctors, and they all do different things.
Yeah. I'm under four consultants. I have four different consultants to look after my eyes.
Just for your eye. It's too much. It's a good and it's a bad thing, right? It's a good thing because we've got great options for all these very specific things for the eye. But it's a bad thing because it all takes time and energy to see all these doctors.
Thank you, Charles. And I think that links back to our point around administration for us as patients. And Stella, we've spoken about treatments that are available, but from your perspective, are there still limitations?
Definitely. There are still limitations despite the presence of different types of treatments, as Bernadette said. We have different types of anti-VEGF for diabetic maculopathy. We have also the steroids. We have laser. But these treatments need to be constantly injected. So there is a huge burden for the patients and also for the healthcare professionals. So we definitely need the treatment that is more long-lasting. So the patients could come just a couple of times during the year, and treatments that are obviously very safe, so they don't need the monitoring in between the treatments. And it also would be very important to have earlier treatment. It would be better if we could prevent the onset of diabetic macular edema or proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
Thank you. And I think just in terms of what we've spoken about, Stella, you mentioned about having long-lasting treatment. We've spoken about the administrative burden that's on a person living with diabetic retinopathy, and you're adjusting to your quality of life potentially changing. And actually, it can fluctuate quite a bit. When I had the bleed in my right eye, there was a certain point where I couldn't see quite clearly out of my right eye. For that period of time, my quality of life is very, very different. Bernadette, if I bring you into the conversation at this point and just talk about how the diagnosis, the impact that it's had on you and your quality of life.
So in 2012, I lost my job as a teacher. And then in 2013, I lost my driving license and I've not been able to drive since. And in 2016, I was registered as sight impaired. And actually, it's really hard. But when you have diabetes and the sight loss, it's almost like the ugly side of diabetes, it's the dark side of diabetes. If I go into an environment where there are people with diabetes, lab by long cane, and there's that, you know, oh, she didn't look after her diabetes, did she? That's really hard. I do think there is stigma in the diabetes world for those that have retinopathy, especially if it's obvious they've got a sylos. I do feel there is a little bit of judgment there, and I think it's something that needs to stop, really. Unfortunately, treatment for me didn't work. So, you know, I think we need to have a more empathy, understanding of those with diabetes and sylos.
Can I step into this? Because really, thank you for explaining what parts of your life were mostly affected. Can I ask also, Randall, was it more the loss of independence or mobility that was mostly affected when you lost your sight?
So there was the loss of vision to a certain severity with each case, resulting in having surgery done at an outpatient facility here in the U.S. They were able to remove the liquid from the eye and repair the damage. So far, I have been lucky. But what I do have now is, I guess, an immense fear of what the next episode, maybe, if I quote unquote call it that episode, as Daniel noted earlier in regards to seeing floaters. If I see a floater, I'm beginning to wonder, okay, is this one of the symptoms that I'm looking for prior to the capillaries rupturing and resulting in another vitrectomy surgery? Because in my previous cases, I would have those floaters. So I do have a bit more fear and anxiety when those things pop up, even though I'm set now for annual exams with my ophthalmologist. If something comes up enough to cause concern, I will call them and say, hey, let's get in a little bit quicker, just to at least relieve that fear or see if anything's going on and try to get on a treatment plan.
Thank you, Randall. Just to build on what you and Bernadette have shared, particularly around the floater part, Randall, what you touched on is very key, because you have a hyper awareness now of what's going on in your eyes. And sometimes I've looked at a light colored wall in the house and there's been a small black dot on the wall, and I thought, is this a floater? What does this now mean for me? And I didn't think that way prior to having diabetic retinopathy. But there's a switch that's now on to be hyper aware of everything that's happening. And Bernadette, you mentioned about the stigma that you've experienced. And that the reason why I bring that up is it links back to what Charles said at the very start around diabetic retinopathy being linked to the length of time that you're living with the condition. And I think that's perhaps a key part that's missing in some of the conversations around retinopathy, is that I didn't know until many years later that the length of time living with type 1 diabetes increased my chances of developing diabetic retinopathy. And that's key. And Stella, as a healthcare professional, listening to the three of us share our experiences, how could ophthalmologists or healthcare professionals working within diabetic retinopathy help patients better?
I really appreciated all of your points, because they are really the same one that I also hear from my patients. So the fear is definitely something that is the major problem, both for the early diagnosis and then for coming and continuing the treatments. I think that we as the healthcare professionals would need to definitely to talk earlier to the patients, to access them also to the patients' groups. So we need to have the time in our everyday busy clinic, and that's something that is challenging. I think the group of patients are something, the patients that are affected by diabetic retinopathy is a very good way where we can approach a lot of patients with diabetic retinopathy and share with them everything what is needed to do to prevent the onset of the advanced stages of the disease.
Thank you, Stella. And you're right there. We've spoken about the past, we've spoken about the present, but now let's talk about the future when it comes to diabetic retinopathy management and when it comes to research. What kind of considerations should be out there in the research world when it comes to including the patient's perspective in designing and conducting clinical trials?
The studies in diabetic retinopathies are very long. They require a lot of monitoring visits for the patient. So that's why it's not always easy to retain the patients, not just to recruit them at the beginning, but also to make them take the drug and continue all the study and all the appointments. So if we include them from the beginning of the design of the study, I think they would be more than willing, understanding the importance of the results, to do it up until the end.
I agree. I think, you know, some other thoughts there are listening to patients about what are the major problems that they have and what they would like to see for new treatments. I mean, it's interesting how there's so many companies right now that are developing new drugs, and it's so rare that those companies go to patients to listen to what they have to say. The companies go to, you know, doctors like Stella and me to talk about what we want all the time, and then we translate what patients want, but it would be good to go to the source and have the companies directly try to be engaging with patients about what would make your life better, not what we think will make your life better. I think that would help innovation a lot. And to put a little hope out there also, the injections work very well, but they are scary. I mean, you're going to put a needle in my wear? No thanks. I totally get that. And I've had patients that have flat out refused and many not come back because of it. But the future is hopeful.
I completely agree. I think treatments have to start from the patient because they're the ones taking it. I'm actually part of NICE and I'm a lay member of the Royal College of Ophthalmology in the UK. And I hear a lot of research about this, that and the other. And who would want to have an injection in their eye? Actually, I don't mind injections in my eye, but everyone says, oh, no, you'd prefer an eye drop. Yes, but what is that eye drop mean? Does that mean I have to take the eye drop myself? Because if I did, would that be every day? I would take enough eye drops. For my eye injection, I just have to go once a month to the hospital, lay on the couch and look in the right place. That's all I have to do. But if there was an eye drop I had to put in every day, that is a lot more of a health burden to me. So I think it's imperative to start from a patient's perspective, really, because they're the ones that are going to have to go along with the treatment.
For you, what would be an ideal type of treatment and how often it should be?
The injection for me has been fine. I mean, I think they've taken away the worry of infections. You know, less needed injection that can elongate treatment. For me, there's injections that are fine because I think the responsibility on me is very little. If you give me treatments to take at home, that's a lot more responsibility for me. But also, having to go to the hospital once a month, my eyes are being checked every month. I feel I'm being well looked after. So even if I was giving an eye drop or something and I had that was where it went, I'd still want to feel I was being looked after well at the hospital. People already living with diabetes have a lot of things they're coping with and a lot of medical bits they're having to take and use themselves. So I think it's anything that can ease that off would be really beneficial.
Thank you, Bernadette. And Randall, what does improving the future look like to you?
Even in my short time of actually having to have surgical procedures done, I have seen an improvement, even just from going from laser treatment to injections. I can see that those are continually improving. And I think research is, of course, important as far as trying to get those new treatments out onto the market, or at least in a trial basis for patients that may opt for trials. I think just trying to give an overall idea for the practitioners to, I know this is difficult, but to explain, really kind of give you an emotional side to those patients. Because when they hear vision loss, that is a very emotional thing for a patient to go through. And so I know that's often hard with the healthcare system where it is where you have to have X amount of patients a day. But that could lead into support groups. If there are support groups that could make themselves available to the doctor's office and then connect those with the patients so that they can connect. So you can share experiences. Met people through their support groups that have had similar conditions. And so a lot of times they can give me their experience and that seems to ease my mind. So those are things that I think would be better for the future.
Can I just bring one more thing up? and that is research is imperative, but we patients are not hearing enough about research. I hear about it because of the work that I do, but for a long time, I didn't think there was any research into DMO. Please let us know about research. I really want that to change. We've got to hear that we're not being left out. We are also being thought of.
Thank you, Bernadette. I think that as we're talking about the future, something that has perhaps come up in the key theme is communication. Communication is key to how the future of diabetic retinopathy management changes and progresses. And I think for me, the key part of that is the support that you as a person living with diabetic retinopathy gets from your healthcare professional in that room, in your appointment, but also afterwards as well. So it links to what you've said, Bernadette, and you as well, Randall, where you talk about peer support. And another part of communication is the awareness around that diabetic retinopathy looks different in every single person. And I guess that's more on the healthcare professional side than the patient side, also actually the research side as well.
An interesting thing that Bernadette says, that actually patients to have the treatments that are delivered by the physician, because they feel like it is not their responsibility. They don't like the treatments that could be administered by themselves. So the biggest thing that I learned from you tonight, from this conversation, is that we as the healthcare professionals need definitely to reach to you earlier, to talk to you more, to explain more to each patient what is diabetic retinopathy, what is maculopathy, what are the perils if the patients are not followed properly, what are the new treatments that are available, and also if we can tell you about the new research that is not just for the swelling of the macula, but also for, let's say, the ischemic part of the maculopathy, that is something that is less known, and it is under the research. We still don't have the treatment, but something definitely interesting.
Thank you, Stella. And I think on that note, I would like to thank Stella, Charles, Bernadette, and Randall for such an insightful discussion.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.